Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Carrie Adloyd. How do we grieve for someone? How does it change and evolve as we get older? My dad died when I was 15, and it took me many, many years to be able to express what I had gone through. So I decided to create Griefcast, a chance to talk, share and laugh about the weirdness of grief and death. But with comedians, so it's not that depressing, I promise. Each time I talk to a different comedian about their own personal experience of grief, as we remember someone that they have lost along the way. Whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club, this is a chance to talk about the peculiar human process of death. Welcome to Griefcast.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, Greasers, I hope you're having an okay week. If you have been enjoying the show, please do rate and review and subscribe. I know I always ask that, but it really does help other people find the show. If you've done so already, huge, huge thank you. It is much appreciated. This episode is a bit of a special episode because November is Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month. You might not know that, but it is. As I'm sure regular listeners will know, my dad died of pancreatic cancer, and I have worked a lot with PCUK and PCRF, who are two amazing charities working in the UK to raise awareness and research of pancreatic cancer. It is the fifth most common cause of cancer death in the UK, but it receives barely any funding compared to the others. And PCUK have launched a new campaign called Demand Survival Now to run in association with Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month. Because basically, despite huge progress in the diagnosis and treatment in recent decades, pancreatic cancer remains the deadliest common cancer. It is 8 times more deadly than the other common cancers like prostate, breast or bowel cancer. Now, obviously, I know there's not a hierarchy of cancer, and if anyone has cancer, any type of cancer, it's awful. But pancreatic has had such little research, so lots of people, there's not a lot of treatment for it. There are no screening programs or early detection tests, and very vague symptoms such as back pain, indigestion or weight loss. So that means tragically, pancreatic cancer is detected too late to save lives. 1 in 4 people die within a month of diagnosis, which is pretty crap. So PCUK are asking the government to recognise pancreatic cancer as an emergency and act so that we can transform survival. If you head to www.demandsurvivalnow.org.uk, you can share the petition and you can sign it, and obviously spread the word on social media and just help raise awareness of what is a pretty dreadful cancer, as myself and a lot of the guests we've had on. Which leads me to the guests we're talking about this week. I am talking to actress Olivia Williams. You'll recognise Olivia. She has been in so many things. She was in Emma, Jane Austen's Emma TV adaptation that I very much enjoy. She was in Rushmore. She was in Sixth Sense. She was in The Heart of Me and Education. She's done loads of TV. She was in a big Joss Whedon series called Dollhouse. She's in a new one coming out called The Nevers that he's doing. She's a theatre actress. She's incredible. She's absolutely amazing, amazing lady who's worked consistently for many years and absolutely brilliant performer. Olivia came in to talk to me about her dad, but also to talk about her journey with cancer. Olivia was diagnosed with a form of cancer in her pancreas, so not pancreatic cancer, but she's one of the few people who is surviving her cancer because it wasn't officially pancreatic cancer, which is why she's talking to me this week, especially to launch Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month. Welcome to Griefcast. I'm here today with actress Olivia Williams. Hello.
Hello.
Thank you so much for joining me. Olivia, you've been in so many things.
I have been around a while.
In a nice way.
I'm a cook. But, you can't offend me on the age or prolific.
But I was thinking, I was looking on the way here, of things you've done, and it's really broad. And I feel like you're almost a dangerous actress because it's the kind of career that someone at drama school would be like, see, you can do all these things and still, just exist off acting. It's an incredible career that you've had.
Yeah. I do, when I'm asked to go and talk at drama schools and schools, I never get asked back because I say, this is an anomaly.
Yeah.
It was bizarre. I can't tell you how I did it. And I don't know that this can be replicated.
Yeah.
I was like the mosquito that hit a vein, at various
Because you've
points.
Not been pigeonholed either. That's why I was looking at everything you've done. And you might feel differently. But I feel like, sometimes people they're stuck in theatre or they're stuck in film. And even though you can think they're brilliant, you can see they're kind of playing the same things. Whereas you've done so much theatre, so much film, so much television, lots of interesting roles. Doesn't feel like you've done period stuff and modern stuff. I, of course, remember you as Jane Fairfax.
Thank you for remembering that production.
Of course.
I think it was a really, really beautiful version of it.
I am in a Jane Austen show. I do a show called Ostentatious, which is an improvised version of Jane Austen, a comedy version of Jane Austen, which you must see.
I must see because I'm obsessed.
You'll enjoy it.
Equally.
So we have watched The Canon many times.
Okay.
But yeah, that was... Jane Fairfax is a great character.
She's brilliant.
Yeah.
And I think a couple of novelists have attempted a kind of spin-off novel about her because she's so interesting and so enigmatic.
Yeah.
And such a passionate dark horse.
That's what I like about you. The whole time you're like, we don't really know Jane Fairfax.
Yeah, she's got a double life.
Yeah.
She's getting it on with Frank in the background and pretending she's this ice maiden.
I know.
So gotta love her.
Yeah.
And I'm obsessed about Jane Austen as well. And I did a sort of biopic. Everything I do seems to... At one point in my career, I was making the second movie of the great breakout directors. And there was another time when I was making the same show at the same time as much more bigger stars. We did our Emma at the same time as Gwyneth Paltrow did hers. And I did Miss Austen Regret at the same time. And quite a lot of people sort of say, I loved you in Becoming Jane. I was like, no, you didn't. Wrong Jane Austen.
Wrong one. Yeah. That's the trouble, that if you're into the Austen canon, I also blur them in occasionally. Especially if it was a TV one, because was it BBC? Was it ITV? Yeah. What were they in? And the costumes, obviously, just all blur into one. Apart from that one they did recently. This is really geeky. The one they did recently, last year, a couple of years ago, it was the early one. Sorry, this is so geeky. And they went, all the costume was really modern. As in, it was when I say modern, I mean.
Not strictly speaking to the...
Modern? I mean 1790s, not 1814. That's how much a geek I am. And that's the only one I can separate.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's...
Roger Michell's Persuasion is my definitive, the best adaptation ever.
That.
You have
to. Is that the BBC one?
I don't know which channel it was on.
It's an old one.
It's old. It's Roger Michell directing Persuasion.
I've seen clips, yes.
And it's... not a foot wrong in casting, in emotion, it's just beautiful. It's beautiful. And he has a complete anti-wig fetish. So no one's allowed to wear wigs. No one's allowed to shave. No one's allowed to go in and have their hair redone after every take.
Nice.
And so it's real, but it's not fakely gritty. It's still Jane Austen. It's still kind of intellectual gymnastics that she has.
Which suits Persuasion.
Yeah.
Very much. Very much.
Yeah.
And I think that's very cool to like Persuasion.
Oh.
Because we always say, when I'm talking about it, because I have to talk about it a lot, I'm always P&P is your gateway drug.
Yeah.
But the connoisseur likes Persuasion.
Well, go to it. Go to it and watch Sophie Thompson eat a pork pie. And
Sophie Thompson playing?
She's genius.
Oh,
in
I love
it.
Her
it's
so
she's
much.
Genius.
I can't believe I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, go now.
Okay, I'm going now.
It's perfect pregnancy material.
Sadly, we're not remembering Jane Austen.
No.
Although we both easily could do our, yeah, that should be my next podcast. So who are we remembering today?
I'm adding to the list of and I think largely women, remembering their dads. My father, Graham Williams.
Graham Williams.
Yes.
That's a very classy name, Graham Williams. Yeah, there is a lot of women talking about their dads, but I think that's okay.
That's okay. And I think in this age of patriarchy bashing that those paters who were supportive of women need to be shouted out for. His christening present to my daughter was a copy of Mary Wollstonecraft's A Declaration of the Rights of Women.
What a cool man!
Cool dad.
That is so cool!
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. It just took me back to my my grandfather, like, I think just gave, you know, the spoon or something. Like that. But my grandmother...
Handy spoon.
Yeah, my grandmother used to sit me aside and try and always teach me bridge. And I could never, ever learn it. And she always used to say, Carrie, you have to learn it for when you get married, your husband will bring people over and you'll need to play bridge. This was like... And I remember thinking... This doesn't seem like a strong enough reason to learn this incredibly complicated and boring card game.
I had a similar grandmother experience. She she paid for me to learn to ride because she thought I would meet the right sort of young man. What she didn't know is that by my generation, riding would become the preserve of posh lesbians. And that I met a lot of really interesting, tough, posh lesbians riding horses all over the world, but never any suitable
great.
Men. Yeah, it was a very,
I
very...
I didn't meet any cool lesbians at the bridge club, I tell you. It was really boring.
Lots of no need to make a fuss, you know, women who'd been sort of attacked on horseback by a lion. And, they were very cool.
So remembering Graham.
Graham Williams.
Yes. So when did Graham die?
In 2013, November 2013.
So how long?
It's 2019 now and heading towards November. So
you're coming up for the...
Don't you do maths?
I know, both of us are looking at us like, Olivia, please don't make me do it.
I'm an actress, not a mathematician. Six.
13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. Six.
Yeah.
God, I love
plus
I was thinking,
three is nine.
I was thinking, please, you do it. Don't make me do it. We're both as bad
panic
as each
in our
other.
Eyes
yeah,
across the table.
Because normally someone always does it for me. They look at me like, God, she can't do that.
Yeah. It's no, six, I Karen. Knew last year it was five, but I hadn't quite got around to the next
no,
one.
No, that's fine. So six. Oh yeah, coming up very, very soon.
Yeah.
So how are you feeling about 6 years? Has it changed particularly, or
it's changed hugely? This is going to get very nerdy very quickly, but I was doing a play that I love called Mosquitoes by a genius called Lucy Kirkwood, which was about physics and the Hadron Collider. And I met a guy I knew from Camden Town where I grew up. I was on my bike and he was biking the other way and he jumped off his bike and he said, if you need any help with explaining physics and time and planes of existence and parallel universes, you know, I'm your man.
And that is not what old friends normally shout.
No,
I'm
he's very clever. Dr. Dan Glazer. And he explaining science to the public is his thing. And then I told him that my dad had died and he described this extraordinary phenomenon that he believes in, that if you imagine a line with a dot in it and that dot is the point of death of someone you love and you're on one side of the line moving, say, to the right and your memories of that person are on the other side of the line moving to the left. Mm. And as you move to the right, away from the point of death, you remember your loved one as they were when they died.
Yes, yeah.
And then as you get further along the line, they move further along the line in the opposite direction and you remember them as they were when they and you were younger and younger. And that's really happening. I'm getting many more memories of my dad now as he was when I was a young child, whereas he'd been sick for 12, 14 years when he died. And we were all overwhelmed with the grateful release theory of grief for a long time because he was done, really.
It's so common. And I get asked that a lot of people going, oh, I can only remember them sick. And I'm always like, it will pass. Because I had that as well. Like, because he... he was sick for not a very long time, but it like burnt into my memory and he went very yellow and he was just walking around the house looking like, you know, a sick person. Mm-hmm. And that's all I could see for a couple of years was a sick person. And then you're right, suddenly you get this flash and they're healthy. Yeah. And you think, oh yeah, they were healthy, weren't they? And it's such a nice place to get to, isn't it? After all, like, illness has been, like, you've just been breathing in illness. So what did he die of?
In the end, he died of a heart attack, but his sense of humour was still just about functioning. You know, his list of ailments was just astounding by the time he died. He was always celiac, which has become very trendy now, but he had it first, and had colitis, but then he had a heart attack in 1999, and instead of spending the millennium, you know, having a reunion with people I'd known, as I'd said I would in Trafalgar Square, we were all in UCH around his bedside, and then recovering from the heart attack, he had a stroke, which made him limp, and then he had the lifelong colitis and celiac caused cancer in his colon, and so that was massive complications. So he was like a roller coaster. He'd get better from one thing and then plunge down the roller coaster. But he was such a fighter and he was so bloody minded. He just, you know, he and my mum went traveling after he was sick. He was like sort of Henry VIII. They hitched him onto a donkey and he went down Grand Canyon on a donkey after his stroke without any guts to speak of. You know, I mean, just mad.
So he was very determined it wouldn't stop him
absolutely
from doing anything.
Yeah. And we've talked a bit about in the family about the sort of letting go thing, and in a way I wish he'd let himself go a little bit.
Yeah, it's true. Sooner. My dad was like in complete denial like the whole time. I said it was very brief, but he was planning trips, you know, lying in the hospital, and he was like dead the next week, but he was telling us to book flights and things. And I remember my mum getting really frustrated, and that's been ironically a big thing with my therapist of the frustration of not being able to get to someone to say, like, it's okay, like, this is happening, we want to talk about it, the living people, but you can understand, I guess, that if he was a strong, healthy man all that time, it's just like, no, this is not happening.
There were things he wanted to see and things he still wanted to do, where the sign really was when one of his incredible gifts that he passed on to me was the ability to see joy in really small, simple things. And right at the end, he lost that. He stopped taking pleasure in these, you know, like, you know, watching leaves fall or you know, the sound of the rain on cobbles, you know, just he had a really beautiful sense of the beauty in the small thing. But the night he died, my mum says, you know, what he said to her, he was feeling very unwell. And he said, whatever happens tonight, I love you very much. So I think he knew that that was the last.
So were you with him when he died, or?
That is a tricky one. I wasn't with him. My husband and I had been in Venice for our wedding anniversary, which, again, is very mixed up with my dad first took me to Venice. He loved Venice. It was like one of his magical places that he introduced me to. And I painted a little watercolour for view from the window of our hotel room and emailed it to him while I was there. And we went to this church that he loved. He took me to. It was his favourite place, called San Zaccaria in Venice. And I was sort of desperate to go there. We'd gone and looked at the Architectural Biennale, my husband and I. And I just said, I just want to go to San Zaccaria before we go. Yeah. And we literally went on the way to the airport to get the boat. And I went in and did that very Italian Catholic thing of putting money in and lighting a candle. And we flew home and we went to bed. And for some reason, I looked at my phone and it was ringing, and it was my mum. And she said, actually, I think it was my sister. And she said, go to mum and dad's. Dad's not well. And the flashing light was outside the house. Mm. And I went up to the bedroom and they were trying to revive him. And so I think I missed him. I mean, he was gone.
Yeah.
But they were still, you know, there's that thing. They asked the most bizarre questions, like, was he expected to die? And I was like, look at, you know, he had 10 different illnesses. He was in his 70s.
Yeah.
You know, don't try and bring him back. But
yeah.
I think my mum wasn't ready for him to go. And in the panic of the moment, she's going, no, no, he wasn't ready to die. Yeah. He wasn't ready to die. And I was going, let him go. He was very dramatic. And I was going, let him go.
It's so hard. And I, like, now I've read lots of books about, you know, how you can plan and how you can sign a do not resuscitate and all this stuff. But it's only through doing this podcast that I'm even aware of these things. And I think because we don't talk about it, and I guess especially their generation, you know, it's very difficult to bring up the idea of, like, well, if anything happens, maybe just that's it.
Yeah.
And I guess he was at home as well.
Yeah.
The thing is, I think when someone's in hospital, you're all very in the mindset. Mm. Okay.
Yeah.
We're in hospital. This is not, you know, like when my dad went in, my mum was like, he's not coming out. This is it. So I think, if someone's at home, there is still that kind of tiny bit of hope, isn't there? Of like, well, he's not in hospital. Hospital's where people go to die. He's at home.
Yeah.
So maybe he's okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And bizarrely, when someone dies at home and they're not expected to die, it becomes a crime scene. And so these extraordinary people turn up, you know, the police turn up.
Oh my God.
And they take, you know, your loved one off in a body bag to a morgue for a coroner's report on
even
how
though
it happened.
He was so sick.
That's just what happens.
Wow.
So, you know, we had the, you know, everyone could see that it was unlikely that we'd try to bump him off.
something had happened.
You know, they still had to sort of come in and take particulars. And I can't fault everybody was delightful. And everybody, you know, the ambulance men and the women who tried to revive him behaved beautifully.
Mm.
And I got to sort of hold his head and say stuff that I think was quite mad. I think they looked at me at one moment as if to say, is she crazy? But I
She's
got
an actress,
to sort of,
leave her. Exactly. Let her do this.
I was sort of Lady Anne weeping. I knew all the lines.
Absolutely. Why not? That is exactly what we are supposed to do in that moment. And everyone should leave us to it.
and I can remember thinking, do I want to see this? Because I know I'll see it in my mind's eye for the rest of my life. But I thought I had to. I had to. So I did get to say goodbye, but I think he was already gone.
But I think it's almost like it doesn't matter. It's for you.
Yeah.
You need to see it. You need to say it.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes we have that kind of logic part of our brain that's like, why am I doing this?
Yeah.
But I always talk about the fact that after he died, I went back in the room and opened the door to make sure he could get out from the French doors.
Yeah.
And I talked to my brother about it recently because I thought we all went back in and we didn't. Mm. I was the only one that went back in. Again, the actress is here. I need my moment. And my brother said to me, he was like, I just didn't, you know, it wasn't my dad anymore. It was just this thing. And I was like, I suddenly thought, it mattered to me that I went and said those things and said goodbye. And I think sometimes it's the thing we're sometimes like, maybe it's a British thing, we're sometimes too practical with ourselves. Oh, don't be silly. They're gone. What does it matter? And it's like, no, maybe you just need to. Maybe it is silly, but you need to.
Yeah,
so
I wanted
that
to be sentimental and I wanted to say things. And I did want to look at his face, you know.
Yeah.
I did want to, and I couldn't. Anyway, I did go back in the room. And then however long it is afterwards, my mum, who is Catholic, wanted to, you know, do the big viewing the body in the funeral parlour, which that I did feel was, you know, Graham Williams had left the building. But but I'm glad I was there the night he died, even though I'm not sure I was there when he died. It resulted in this bizarre thing. This is only could have happened to an actress because my mum quite reasonably wanted to know where they were taking him. And this black body bag. And they said, well, the morgue in King's Cross is being refurbished, so he's going to Poplar.
Right.
And I've been in Poplar Morgue in a fridge on a zinc bed. And it's like, I've been there.
And why have you done that, Olivia? Perhaps
I'm an actress and I played a dead body in a cop show as one of my early jobs.
Oh my God.
And so the guys were carrying it looked completely bemused. And because it was sort of out of my mouth before I realised. It's like, I know that fridge.
You can't help yourself. Oh, yeah, I've done that. We filmed it, yeah.
And then my mum, who's just my agent and publicist and the proudest mum ever, but you know, she's an actress, you may have seen her, and got into this conversation of telling the people carrying my father's body out the front door what shows I've been in.
And The Sixth Sense. Yeah.
You think you're joking, but actually, I think that may have come up.
But, so you were in a TV police drama show.
Yeah, yeah.
And you had to be, that is my actual fucking nightmare. Like, yeah. I am one of those actors who'd be like, nah, you know what? I don't think I can do that job. Because to go in a, I couldn't do that, Olivia, I couldn't.
Well, when you take the job, you think it's going to be done on a set, don't you? You think they're going to build a set somewhere in a studio. But, you know,
have to be in an actual
finances
morgue.
We were in Poplar Morgue. And I had the full, plaster cast of my face. So they built my character drowned, so it was swollen. And so I had a full sort of rubber mask.
Even worse, that's my other nightmares when they do that face thing. Yeah. I can't bear it.
And they put like Thames mud in my hair, so I have to be wet. And at the weekend, they turn off all the heating in the morgue at Poplar.
Oh my God, this is getting worse.
It was a nightmare. And they had to put me in the fridge and then film me being drawn out of the fridge. And I wasn't next to dead bodies, but I could see some down the end. It was sort of L-shaped, massive fridge, like a room. And they're down, all the trays around me were empty, but there were some down the end with some feet with labels on.
Oh my God, Olivia!
I know. And they pulled me out of the fridge for the identification. Lovely Jason Fleming had to identify my body. And I was shivering. And so the director goes, could you stop shivering?
I'm like, fucking cold.
Well, the point is that's an involuntary reaction to being cold.
You know, like, I'm in a fridge.
The key being involuntary.
Yeah.
And so one of the sparks, bright spark, had the idea of putting a light under the zinc bed to warm me up. And so my arse was sort of frying on the zinc. And like my nipples were still like wingnuts that were sticking out through them. But I did stop shivering long enough the shot. Anyway, after this grim early job, I staggered back and I, you know, to my shame, still lived with my parents. And, there was my mum and dad with a hot toddy and the sort of leftovers of Sunday lunch because it was on a Sunday. Going, you know, darling, you know, this, you know, it'll be all right.
It'll be worth it one day.
Your career will turn.
Oh,
take a turn for the better. And then my poor old dad ended up in the same fridge.
That's so bizarre.
So I think I must be the only person who's been to a fridge before and come out. And then,
because most people don't. Yeah, that's fair to say. Once you're in the fridge, you're not really getting up out of the fridge. Yeah.
No.
Oh my God, Olivia, that must have been so surreal.
It was. And that was, you know, it was one of those situations, as I said, with my mum and me at the door and my mum going into the career pattern with the sort of stretcher bearers. That was surreal. And we had a laugh about it that night, and my dad would have enjoyed. You know, the one thing he always did, and which we do as a family, is turn everything into an anecdote.
Yeah.
And he would have loved that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good one.
And it is about the only time in my life where I've been somewhere before my dad. Because my parents were really big travellers. And so every time I go anywhere exotic, they've always been there before. But to Poplar Morgue.
I got there first.
Yes.
So then you have the funeral. And did you speak at the funeral or anything like that?
I did. Again, like
actors,
many of your other actor interviewees, I did speak and I write a bit as well. So I wrote about him, but I tried to incorporate things. Again, some of your other interviewees have said, you know, and a lovely turnout of my friends and my sister's friends were there, and lots of things that people had written I'd managed to incorporate. Well, a wonderful actress friend of mine called Anastasia Hilly wrote that he was an establishment bohemian. You know, he was a lawyer and a QC and a recorder, which is a type of judge, but he also was chaotic and artistic and very humorous parts of him, which being a lawyer doesn't really represent. And my parents had a house with a flat at the top. And many of my actor friends passed through that house, and many of them were there. All had to sign tenancy agreements, which was a bit puzzling for them at the time.
What a great solicitor. That's perfect.
They weren't going to have any people, you know, claiming that they could stay endlessly. But they generously and joyfully entertained many of my friends at the end of the garden.
And so how did you find that initial... So you've got kids yourself.
Yeah.
So how did you find that sort of period of, okay, he's now dead, I'm grieving, but I still have to be a mother and for these children and carry on and be, I guess you were still working. Like, how was that sort of first year? Did you find it difficult or how did you cope?
It was hard. I mean, we were a very close family, my sister, my mum, my dad and me. And a lot of it was centering around my mum, and you know, she'd lost her life partner. Yeah. And I still have this thing, which is the lovely connection I have with friends who knew my dad very well. It's like there are very few people who understand how amazing he was, and sadly my husband really only met him when he was declining. Yeah. And my children didn't really know him, although I'm so happy that they did know him and they grieved for him. They were sad. But I was like, no, you don't understand why.
It's really hard. I had that with my grandpa, because my grandpa was a solicitor and a real character. Mm. And it's so hard sometimes when you tell a story and everyone's like, oh, right. And you're like, no, you don't understand what it's like to be in a room with them. It was... in magic. Yeah. It was something else. And even though he was a very flawed character in many other ways, I discovered later, I know that frustration when you're like, oh, that's the shit thing about death. Like, you can't really conjure someone up sometimes, can you?
And the idea, I mean, I've just decided, as I have with many things, is I just have to do the things in honour of him trying to force my poor children to appreciate, you know, Venetian Renaissance art and, you know, and Persian rugs was his other obsession. He used to take me to Sotheby's to the auctions of Persian rugs.
And oh, my God!
One of the things that he loved, one of the happiest moments of his life was that these auctions at Sotheby's are full of Persian rug dealers who like the guys who really know for a lot of them from, you know, Iran and Iraq, and they have shops in London, and they all bid for the rugs. And my dad always used to go and come back with another rug. The house was covered in, they were on the walls, on the tables, on the floors. And one time one of the really classy dealers came up and said, where is your shop? And the fact that he thought my dad had a Persian rug shop was just like, yeah.
So that's so sweet. It was like, I don't even have one. I just love them
and collect them.
This man was like, where are they? He's stealing these rugs from me.
Yeah, picking all the good ones. Just those things that he would, you know, if I had an afternoon off school as I got older, you know, we'd go on a little outing and go and bid for a Persian rug and go to a museum and see an obscure show about, you know, early Renaissance art or something.
He sounds like he was very involved in your life, like in a really... Yeah, like in a big way.
I mean, you know, some might say unhealthy. There are some boyfriends who, you know...
I think that's nice. I think that's
threatening, but...
I think that shows real love. It shows real love to, like, express your passion and take your child with you and not be like, oh, you know, I don't want them there, they'll be annoying or they won't understand it. Like, it's so easy when you see parents distancing themselves, and it sounds like... Yeah, that really love. And I think as a child, you feel so special, don't you? You're like, oh, wow. I'm kind of like, included. My grandpa was very good at that as well. Like, you know, I'm going to take you to see this thing because I think it's interesting. You're like, oh, I don't know what it is, but okay.
And I wanted to love it if he loved it.
Yeah, of course.
But and the other thing that he was brilliant at was organising holidays. He would plan holidays. But then when we used to go to the south of France, and he'd always look out for posters for like circuses or a fair. And we'd end up going to these awful, you know, sort of 70s fairs where they would sort of, where, you know, the plate spinner had holes in her tights and fell off the galloping pony. And, you know, but they would make him laugh. The worse it was, the more he enjoyed it. Yeah. And I have one friend who still says when he does a play, like, he used to invite my dad, because my dad's laugh, you could hear it from the stage. And they tried to get me to play the violin when I was young, and I was hopeless at it. But I was in a production of Peer Gynt at the RSC, and it was a production where you were on stage all the time, and I was playing a troll, and we all had to play musical instruments. And early rehearsal, John Barton, this god of poetry and directing, said, you know, does anyone play a musical instrument? And I was like, yes, I play the violin. So there I was on the RSC stage playing the violin. My dad knew how shit I was at playing the violin. And every time I picked up that violin, he roared with laughter, whether it was a funny scene or a happy scene or a sad scene, all the way through Alex Jennings, Peer Gynt. He just, every time I touched the violin, he just...
Here she goes.
Yeah, here she goes. And he literally was sort of saying, I can't believe people are paying £30 a ticket to listen to you play the violin.
That's so funny, yeah.
But
that's
while
so
being
nice.
So supportive of my career.
Yeah, yeah. But just like the way only a family can support you. I love you, but you know you're awful at that. At that. You're like, yeah. No, I'm not. No. The director hasn't said so. And everyone's like, yeah, I get that sense. Maybe other people think this as well. That's hilarious.
But he was also supportive of my friend. You know, he was judging in Nottingham, and my dear friend Lucy, I'm doing big name drops, sorry, but Lucy Bryce, shout out to Lucy Bryce, who's also lost an amazing dad, and she was in a play, she was in sort of She Stoops to Conquer.
Oh, yeah.
And after court, he bought a bunch of flowers, and he always used to take his bicycle on the train, so he had his bicycle out, which was a fold-up bike, and a yellow waterproof anorak and a bunch of garage flowers. And he went around to the stage door of Nottingham Playhouse, and someone went into Lucy's dressing room and said, there's this really weird guy in a yellow Mac with some garage flowers who says he knows you. And it was my dad. And he took her out for dinner and to her for a curry in Nottingham. And, you know, he was just a generally... if he was somewhere, he wanted to do something in that place, of that place. And I just want to communicate that curiosity and joy in things, whether they're great or small.
Yeah, yeah.
To everybody.
But I think you will. And that's the thing, is like, you know, your children are teenagers, so I'm sure they're rolling their eyes at you now. But like, it does get passed on, you know? And then, like you said, like now when you're older and you want to look at Persian rugs and go to Venice Renaissance, I'm sure there's a time in your life where you're like, not another Persian rug. And I think it does get part. That's all you... It's all you can do. And I sort of come to this, like, obviously a very hippie conclusion, thanks to my parents, but like, that all a parent can do is love a child so much that when they're gone, they still feel that love.
Yeah.
And there's not much else you can control, you know, you give them money, they could ruin it and burn it, lose it. Like, but if you can just love them so much that eventually they can walk away and go, yeah, I did feel loved, even though they're not here anymore and I don't get to hear it and they don't get to tell me.
Yeah.
And it took me such a long time because we had like a difficult relationship and obviously I didn't have a lot of time with him, but I can walk away going, yeah, I definitely knew he loved me. I definitely feel that still, you know. There's other issues.
No, but it's difficult. I mean, I feel that so strongly for you when my husband's mum died when he was 11. And it was unspeakable. Literally, he couldn't say the word mum when we got together, you know, in his late 30s.
Yeah,
he hadn't dealt with it at all. But to lose a parent in the middle of that incredibly tricky time, you know, 11 was young, but 15, you know, I had a stinking row with my daughter this morning. Just thought, and, you know, you go, is this what you want to, you know, leave? Is this where you want to leave this relationship? It must have been unbearable.
Yeah, it's very tricky because you've left, and I always say this, like, you've left mid-conversation.
Yeah.
And that's very frustrating, is that it was mid-conversation. You are mid-argument, mid-shouting, mid-slamming a door. But both of you know this isn't this isn't how I really feel, you know, this is just how I feel at the moment. So I think that's what takes, and it's so, I mean, I'm not a trained person, as we all know, but everyone I've spoken to who's lost it young doesn't deal with it till about 30.
Oh, yeah, that's
it's so common, because it's like, I think you just can't, like you said, you can't really, you don't have the words, you're sort of stunted in this bit. And then I think you sort of get to like late 20s, 30s, and you think, I think I can look at that now. Mm. And I think I can acknowledge, like, oh, you know, it was mid-conversation, but that's, you know, that's sad, but it's okay, I can deal with that. But yeah, it is difficult, but like, it sounds like he just loved you so much. That's all you can hear is just how much love. And that's just...
For a man of his sort of, his traditions and upbringing and generation, you know, he was not someone who was emotionally constricted.
Yeah.
And I can remember at drama school, there was an incredibly annoying teacher who assumed, because I had been to Cambridge and speak the way I do, that I was emotionally stunted in some way. And, you know, listen, he was an 80-year-old. He was old enough to be Prussian. you've got to be really old to actually have been born in Prussia, because it hasn't existed for a long time.
Yeah.
So the following phrase doesn't represent him in a terribly good light. But he said, you know, what you really need, Ducky, is to go out and get raped and really enjoy it. And I was like, for a million reasons, that is offensive.
Jesus Christ. But welcome to the past, everybody. People could say things like that to drama students. Yeah. Welcome to the past. Oh, my God.
But the thing I chose to take offence with at the time is, you think that, you know, I'm emotionally repressed.
Yeah.
And I may be middle class and I may speak like a twat, but I was not raised by emotionally crippled parents.
Yeah.
You know, my father was demonstrative. He'd held hands. He completely supported his daughters to do everything that a son might have done. And, you know, he was cycling along the towpath as my sister was rowing, you know, shouting encouragement. And, you know, so I just, as a feminist, I just want to celebrate him. You know, my mum had a flashier and more kind of noticeable career and a high earning career alongside his, he was his head of chambers and did very well, but he was, if there was someone who he could talk to who would further his career, he would turn on his heel and walk away from them. You know, he had that kind of...
Yeah, I know that sort of point. You sort dignity. Of think, yeah, it just doesn't... It's not in their makeup.
And in
care.
The sort of apprenticeship generation where you put yourself forward, tell everyone how great you are.
Yeah.
You know, he was this person who didn't believe in that kind of self-promotion. And I just... I hope it's not a value that's past, gone.
I don't think so. I don't think so. Because I think, although we do live in a world of self-promotion, I just think not everybody works like that.
Mm.
And not everyone's brains function like that. Yeah. And also, it only works in that sphere, you know, in social media sphere, yes. But, like, the rest of the world doesn't always exist under those laws.
No.
And, you know, so I think, it's not something that's gone yet. And like you said, he's obviously embraced, you know, got that into you, and you are now passing that on to your children.
Doing my best.
It's funny, isn't it? I think what you're saying about the voice is really interesting. I have a similar thing. If you sound like this, people make so many assumptions about you. And again, my family are like very hippie, very mushy.
Mm.
Plus my mum is working class, which always throws people very, very upset about that. Because they'd like to go, oh, I know who you are. And especially at that time, it does sound like, especially being a judge and all that, like, it's unusual that he was so demonstrative and feminist. And he sounds amazing.
It was demonstrated, as I said, at his funeral by the Temple Church, which is the church within the temple where all the barristers go, was, you know, absolutely packed out and full of people who he just touched on their lives. And they all just said that he was always pleased to see them, and he was never... You know, again, there might be an assumption of sort of snobbery, and, you know, he wasn't a snob. And in his, when he was head of chambers, there was a lovely woman at the funeral who said, he was the first head of chambers known to allow breastfeeding during chambers meetings. Wow. And, you know, he loved little babies. He loved little babies. Not some men I have heard say of his generation, you know, I've got no time for babies, you know, yeah, where I, yeah. when they can kick a ball, then they're of interest, you know. And, but he was fascinated by newborns, and he just held, like, I have a picture of him holding, thank God he survived to meet my children. Yeah. Looking with such love and fascination at my kids.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing to remember, like, even though they didn't know him in the way you knew him, this, it's not, the stories exist and they knew him, in, his character was still there, but I understand that. Frustration, I think, comes from, like, feeling like a child again, isn't it? Like, no, they're brilliant. Yeah. I want you to know. God, he sounds funny. Great. Sounds funny. Great, Graham. Good on you, Graham.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd.
So you yourself are currently facing a situation. Would you mind telling us what's happening with you at the moment, which is why another reason that we're talking about your own grief? With this.
Well, I feel connected to you because your father died very, very swiftly of pancreatic cancer. And I was diagnosed a year and a half ago with a cancer in my pancreas, which is not pancreatic cancer.
Yeah, because
it's to specify that.
Because
it's called a neuroendocrine cancer, and actually, it's really, really, really clever and rare because it's actually called a VIP, which is an absurd collection of letters for a cancer. Not a very important person, but a vasoactive intestinal polypeptide carcinoma. And the joy of a VIP as opposed to pancreatic cancer is it grows very slowly and therefore is operable. And what happened to your dad and to too many friends and people I know, which is to be beyond surgery when you're diagnosed. When I was diagnosed, I was operable.
Which is so rare. So rare for anything once it's in your pancreas.
So I'm you know, the lucky one. I had a VIP, not pancreatic cancer.
I'm so glad they call it VIP. I think that's hilarious.
It's actually, they call it a VIPoma, but being an actress, I have to call it VIP.
Good,
Because it makes me feel a little bit special.
Yeah.
And I've always struggled to get behind the red rope, and now I have a place there that no one can deny. Coming through, make way.
Please read my records.
Yeah, Miss Williams is in the building. So I had that removed, thank God, and am here to tell the tale. A few months after, if it was pancreatic cancer, I would have probably died.
But so you were diagnosed a year and a half ago. That's when
May, June 2018.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So really, yeah, last year.
July 16th, I had massive surgery removing most of my pancreas and my spleen.
Wow.
And then I had a small metastasis in my liver, which they microwaved out of me.
Lovely.
On 31st of August. So,
wow.
And I'm being checked regularly for further metastasis. But what was so shocking was that I had been symptomatic. I had been going to doctors for 4 years saying, there are these really weird things. They're not major. Yeah. I'm not quite sure what they are, but they're very odd. Could we have a little look around? And to be fair to the medical profession, you know, the first symptom was when I drank champagne or ate chocolate, I went red. Weirdly red. You wouldn't give a CT scan to an actress with a champagne allergy. I understand that.
And although now you've heard this, if it does happen again, take it seriously. Champagne allergies.
Yeah, and I'm not talking like, you know, a normal boozy flush. I'm talking creeping redness up your hands and a kind of raised flush on your neck. And of course, you know, because I was in my 40s, it was your perimenopausal and your nutter. And also because of the nature of my job, I was moving around so much. Mm. I never went to see the same doctor twice and I was thrown out of various specialist clinics. You know, the lupus people said, nah, you've not got lupus. And the colon cancer people said, no, it's not colon cancer. And the road to diagnosis, my connection with Pancreatic Cancer UK, is that what we need and what your dad needed and is some test that is not crazily expensive that simply can test for the presence of a pancreatic tumour long before the stage when your dad got to or I got to.
Yeah.
Which, you know, by the time I was operated on, I wasn't holding any food in my body for any significant period of time.
Oh,
and
God.
They were still, you know, saying there's nothing wrong with you and it could be IBS and, you know, just rubbish. Anyway, I, because of my experience with my dad, all those years of being ill and seeing how the medical profession works, I could not be more loving and supportive of the NHS and have more gratitude to doctors. But they're not, they haven't got the kit.
They haven't
got the test.
The resources.
And it was only when I went to America and had, you know, crazy Screen Actors Guild health insurance that I got a CT scan, which revealed a 7x4 centimetre tumour in my pancreas.
God, and nobody had ever looked at your pancreas in all that time.
No. And I can see why, as I said, I didn't give any single doctor enough opportunities to do it. But I just want to... It's such a difficult cancer to support, as you will say, because by the time anybody knows they've got it, it's usually too late.
Yeah, and then they die. And,
die. And for a few years, I'm like, amazing people like Suggs and have supported the charity on behalf of their dead relative. But there's, it's not like, I don't want to belittle anybody, but with breast cancer, you survive, and so you're there to campaign, and you can see that there is.
Oh no,
I got
in trouble before for saying that pancreatic cancer wasn't a fun one, and because I got a lot of people tweeting me saying, "Well, I have this cancer; it's not fun either." I was like, "No, that's not what I mean. Apologies." Yeah. What I mean is, and when I spoke an event for PCUK, it's like, it's no one knows what the pancreas is, no one knows where it is, no one knows what it does.
Yeah.
Whereas, like breast cancer, it's like, okay. And they're like, check for lumps, check for, you know, skin changes. And it's like, there's like a thing you can get your head around of like, oh.
Well, boobs are out front. You can have a look at them.
Yeah, exactly.
Getting to my pancreas took 7 hours.
Oh my God.
7 hours in surgery. This amazing, you know, shout out to Dr. Krishna. Well, he's a surgeon. So he's Mr. Krishna Menon, who managed to get to my pancreas laparoscopically and not mash up my entire internal system, but it's really hard to.
Yeah, it's so hard. And then the symptoms at the moment for pancreatic cancer are very vague. And, you know, although there are, you know, head to the PCUK website where you can see. But they could also be linked to lots of other things.
Exactly.
And there's so many. The event that I spoke to, it was at the House of Parliament, and it was PCUK and PCRF, who are another amazing charity who do research fund. And then there's the PanCan Survivors. And I felt so bad because I met someone. They were like, oh, I'm from PanCan Survivors. And I was like, what? I was like, who? I didn't think anyone. And they were like, no, there's not a lot of us.
No.
But there are different types of pancreatic cancer. Yeah. Obviously, some people do survive if you have a different type. The main
But in
type.
A way, I feel survivor's guilt because I didn't have pancreatic cancer.
Yeah,
and yet, you
know,
Pancreatic Cancer UK came to me. And I said, look, I'm really not that famous. You know, I've been in a few movies, but nobody really knows who I am. And they said, oh, no, we're not asking you because you're famous. We're asking you because there are so few survivors.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, no, well, then I have to say something. So I'm sort of saying it's not what I had, but it's only by the grace of God that even with the one I had they got it in time to save my life. So I just feel, and it's not sort of unrelated to my dad, because one of his illnesses was cancer and it was in his digestive tract. And it's that thing of, I mean, in my attempts to get diagnosed, the point was that this VIPoma, this VIP, releases a hormone when I ate sugar that gave me the most unbelievable diarrhea, like emptying bowels. It was unbelievable. Fortunately, controllable. I'd done my my exercises after childbirth, so but not. And one of the things is one of the last taboos is shit. Talking about it.
I think people would rather talk about death than shit sometimes.
Oh, God, yeah. And, you know, an example of this was, so I'd get this, but it would be a very short, at first, it was a very short-term response to eating sugar. And so by the time I got to the NHS GP, got an appointment, he said, let me take a stool sample. Mm. It was better. And they would go, well, we won't take a stool sample if it's not. Anyway, this is very boring, but it's leading to an important point. It got to a point where I was thought, I've got to show them a stool sample at the worst. So I got a Bon Maman jar, you know, the one with the red gingham lid, sterilised it, and got a beautiful sample which looked rather like Lapsang Souchong tea, and tightened up the lid and put it in three Ziploc bags. And I was in Germany at this point going to see a colonoscopy clinic to try and see if I had colon cancer or some cancer somewhere in my digestive tract. And it was beautiful. It was private. So it was this white place with orchids. And this lovely woman came and was going to sit here. And there was not a fleck of shit anywhere. Yeah. You wouldn't know that the whole place was designed around looking up your ass. And I went into the doctor's office, and her name was Katerina. And she said, well, would you describe your symptoms? And I just whipped out my Bon Maman jar. And she was on one of those wheelie chairs, and she rolled her chair back. She said, why are you showing this to me? I do not want to see this. And I was like,
she's a doctor.
You're a doctor.
You're a colon doctor.
You're a shit doctor in so many ways. And I'm showing you a jar of shit. And
Come on, mate.
Yeah.
Get on
and
board.
And you should be looking at this jar of shit and going, that is extraordinary.
Yeah, that should be fascinating to you. That
you should be happy.
That should be like a dead body to a detective.
Yeah.
Who did this?
Because
how did it happen?
One of the names for a VIP is a list of the symptoms. And so it's WD are the first two letters for watery diarrhea. And I'm like, this is fucking gold dust. You're never going to see. I am one in 10 million. You're never going to see another jar of this shit in your life. So I want to get out there and say to people, if your shit's weird, tell somebody.
Tell someone.
Find out what a normal shit looks like.
Oh, my God.
Because I'd forgotten by that stage.
Yeah, that's the trouble. I've had IBS for years. Mm. So then sometimes people ask you, and you're like, oh, my God, when was the last time it was fine?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know.
What
I
is normal? And our diets are so, and I'm, you know.
And do you recommend a Bon Maman jar specifically?
I love them for all things.
Yes.
And I have, obviously, a great affection for apricot jam. They remind me of the summer holidays with my dad, warm baguette.
Yeah.
big bowl of hot chocolate and bon maman apricot jam. And they are watertight or shit tight.
Now and, we can say officially.
Yeah, yeah. And so we are, I still use them in my kitchen for, you know, those little leftovers, bit of tuna salad that's left over.
Not
I don't
for anything else.
Carry shit around in my handbag anymore. You'll be pleased to know.
I'm glad to know today. I wouldn't have minded.
You've got kids.
Exactly. Oh my God. Yeah, the things you have to deal with when you all squeamishness kind of goes out the water.
Yeah. But for me, it's the last taboo. We've got to talk about shit, and we have to talk. Maybe I should do a shit cast. Anyway,
so you would get people listening. Maybe you wouldn't get the sort of listeners you want. How did you feel? I'm sorry, I'm just laughing so much about my mum. Because when things are normal to you, you're like, it's like your barrier goes, doesn't it? I have this with death. Like, because death, I talk about it so much. Like, I'll ask questions, and I see sometimes, you know, I'm not in the podcast, I think, oh, their face is telling me that was a deeply personal question about their father's death. And I thought it was a fine question, you know, to ask my dentist about whether they saw the body. And I sort of think, oh, right, yeah, because my boundaries, I'm desensitized in the way. I'm sort of opposite to everyone else. And it's the same when you are ill, you know, you have this when you're pregnant and they poke around all the time. You get desensitized to things. Sometimes you tell people things, you're like, oh, I see, yes, you aren't in that situation. Yeah. So for you, what I've said is really shocking.
Yeah.
But for me, talking about my shit or what happened, it's like, yeah, it's not, no big deal.
No big deal.
So how did you cope with, I guess, your own mortality? And so soon after your father's death as well, like that is really... It's not a long time since he passed away.
No, I remember one of the visits to the GP when I was asking for tests, was, you know, because they say, what's your family history? And I was like, it's not great.
Yeah,
And but I kept all the tests for colon cancer and bowel cancer, kept on, for which there are tests.
Yeah,
Just bring it back to the point of my being here in some sense, you know, kept coming back negative. But I remember halfway through saying, will you test this perfectly normal shit for cancer? Falling apart and saying, you know, my dad had colon cancer. I wasn't grieving for, that was abject fear.
Yeah, of course. But I think that's perfectly... Yeah. Perfectly normal, you know. My husband's mother and father died of cancer, and she had bowel cancer, which was completely missed and not diagnosed properly. So of course, any time you go to the doctor, there's any, you're like, yeah, no, there is a bit of history here that I need, and you, I feel like that should be on the record, you know, of like, sometimes when I've had to say it again, I'm like, my dad died of pancreatic cancer, so of course if I have a weird pain in my side and I feel tired, yes, I'm turning up in your surgery being like, and have you checked everything? Because I think it's completely, you've just lived through it, and it's humans, we learn by experience, don't we? So you're like, well, I've learned.
And it sometimes you're right. And, you know, actually, on this occasion, I
was right. Yeah.
And the hilarious German experience, you know, it was a colonoscopy that went up and an endoscopy that went down. And so I thought I'd covered it all. And I got the all clear from them. Sat down in the makeup chair in Berlin and said, I definitely don't have cancer. You know, it was literally like that. And when I eventually was diagnosed and saw all those people again, they just said... We remember you coming in that day and saying, I definitely don't have cancer.
So they just didn't find the pancreas, basically.
Well, endoscopy and colonoscopy stop short of all the kind of...
complicated.
All those, what are they called, things in the digestive tract, you know, all the organs in the middle that actually do the work. It just does the tube that leads to and from.
Yeah.
And the criminal was, the VIP was lurking up the back stairs. So
oh my God. Well, thank God that you did get diagnosed. I mean, that's the... Like
I mean, it was absurd. By the last few weeks, I was in Los Angeles, I was filming 16-hour days, and we were having to stop filming for the noises coming out of my stomach.
Wow.
That were like a sort of Wellington boot being pulled out of Thames mud.
Oh, my God.
And they would go, add action, you know, I can't bear leaving you, you know, but when will I ever see you? Doing these scenes with Oscar winner J.K. Simmons, these parting scenes, and I go... would come out of myself. Okay, sorry, everybody. That's my lunch. Can we just take that again? And oh, JK was just delightful. He'd sort of go, you know, oh, happens to me all the time. You know, let's take that again. He was, and so my digestive tract became the subject. Everyone's got headphones. Yeah. I've got a microphone between my boobs.
Yeah, of course, they can hear everything.
My stomach. And so the idea of being, you know, in any way squeamish about talking about my digestive tract was just gone. Everybody on set.
And that's when you found out when you were filming that?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you tell everyone?
I had to. I went, I was trying to fit in doctor's appointment. I was seeing a gastroenterologist again and again and again while I was filming. Every time I had an appointment, we were missing shooting days. Fortunately, the days in America, on Monday you start at 6 a.m. and you gradually get later as the week goes on. So by Thursday and Friday, I'd have the mornings off, and I was going and having more tests and more tests. And on the morning I was diagnosed, she'd done the CT scan. She sat me down. She said, "You have a 7x4 centimeter tumor in your pancreas." And the tears started going out. I lost a wonderful friend and another actor called Tom Beard to pancreatic cancer a year before that, and I just thought that was done.
Because you hear it and it's like, oh, okay.
And she goes, "Oh no, it's not pancreatic cancer." And I go, "Oh, okay then. I need to go to the set." If it's not pancreatic cancer, I'm going. And she literally got up and held the door handle and said, "You have to go and have a biopsy this afternoon to find out what it is. If it's not pancreatic cancer, we need to know what it is."
Wow.
And so I went in, I had the needle biopsy, and then filmed the next day. And then I got the result, because that gastroenterologist then went on holiday to the south of France. And so the guy who'd done the needle biopsy, I was sitting in my hospital bed preoperatively, and he came and sat down. He was kind of grizzly, Middle Eastern, you know, he must have been Iranian or something. And he sat down and he said, "So I see you're an actress." And I was like, "Yeah." And he said, "I've never heard of you."
Only in LA.
Right.
Only like you get shaded by your doctor. All right.
"Well, I've never heard of you. I'm really good at what I do. I hope you're really good at what you do, because you're about to do it."
Maybe don't worry about my IMDb right now, mate. Anyway, just what's fucking wrong?
Dr. Sensitive was the one who told me I had neuroendocrine cancer by email. And I was sitting in my trailer waiting to shoot another scene with JK, which was the farewell scene. And I was running my lines and knock at the trailer door, and I opened this email and it said, "You have neuroendocrine cancer," and they go, "We're ready for you."
Oh my God.
So I went to the set. I walked to the set like that. Oh, I'm putting my head back to kind of make the tears go back in.
Yeah.
And the AD said, "How are you doing, Olivia?" And I was like, "If I answer you, we won't be getting any more filming done today." And so I have the scene on film.
What is it like watching that scene?
It was so weird.
Yeah.
Because actually, after I was operated on and better, I was doing ADR for the scene back in London, and I'd never seen it. And I watched the scene silently, and I could see my jaw was going and my eyes were like, you could see I was really thinking, but it was kind of right for the scene.
Yeah.
It's so ridiculous, isn't it? Anyway, and I said, "Why are we ADRing it?" They said, "Well, you do this really weird laugh halfway through the scene. JK says, you know, so it's just a question of one foot in front of the other and walk away." And I went, it's like this sort of nasal
like panic
thing.
Emotion escaping.
And I can remember thinking, what am I doing? Trying to summon up some sort of fake tragedy that I'm leaving this person. I've just been told I have cancer. What am I doing here?
And it's funny, because I think sometimes people think with acting, like, oh, you know, you can use it. Like, how wonderful. But actually, it's like crossing the streams. Yeah. And I've had that before when I was doing terrible Fringe Theatre, and, you know, people were like, "Oh, you can just think about your dad." And I was like, No, I can't, because it's so distracting and that pain is hidden and buried and weird. And
you have to block.
Yeah, you've got to block all your other stuff.
You don't want to see what happens when I let that out.
Yeah, yeah, like you're trying to like... So yeah, I can imagine that like trying to act a scene, which is tragic and sad and requires it, but you're also must be completely in shock at the same time as thinking, I knew something was fucking wrong. Yeah. Like, yeah, that is so...
Well, that, I mean, that I'm afraid it doesn't reflect well on my character, but my, you know, I've just been asked to write a piece about the whole diagnosis thing. And they keep on saying, how did you feel? How did you feel? And you know what? It's Spike Milligan's epitaph. Mm. I told you I was ill.
Yeah.
I told you. And I am such a person, I may have inherited this from my other parent, the need to be in the right was so strong that actually I was really glad I had fucking cancer, because you bastards were saying I was fine.
Yeah.
And do you know what? It's a VIP. You know, I was so, the sense of I told you so almost overcame any other sense of tragedy. And this is again why I'm here talking about the importance of diagnosis, because people can only start to do something and help you when they know what's wrong with you.
And
the sense of powerlessness when you know there's something wrong with you. And it's awful, because I know that there are conditions that are mental conditions which are just as bad as physical conditions that need treatment, that where you think you're ill physically and you have a mental condition, you know. I know this is a minefield, but I could see people lose interest. I could see the deadness behind the eyes.
It's difficult. And yeah, pancreatic VIP or pancreatic cancer, whatever you have it, that's why I've ended up talking about it a lot as well. Like, it's deeply unsexy. It's deeply confusing. And what I found so staggering is that, you know, I grew up thinking that my dad died of a very rare disease. I thought it was a very rare, weird disease. And then once I started doing the show and talking about it, and PCRF and PCUK got in touch, and they were like, oh no, it's the fifth biggest cancer killer. And I was like, what? Like, I remember going to my mum being like, guess what? It's the fifth one. And guess what? Its funding hasn't changed since 1970. And my mum was like, oh, because we just thought it was a very rare,
weird
thing. You think
it's very rare because you never meet anyone who's had it.
Yeah.
And having very, very much several removes, but watched what happened with this friend of ours, Tom, you know, that you end up sort of feeling hugely grateful to the sort of hospice staff and the people who get and because of the sense of regret and of what might have been, you can't actually take on trying to find a diagnosis that's going to help people that don't even know they're sick yet.
It's
really difficult funding project to sell to people, because you don't know you've got it. And to find out you've got it is not a happy outcome, but we can do something. They can do something for you if they know you've got it.
If it's caught early enough, but as with all things. But well, Olivia, I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you.
I've never had a guest before. It's really been like, wow, there was a lot of doors and Bon Maman jars and German doctors that got you to this room now.
Yes, I had a story and I'm really glad you gave me the opportunity to tell it.
No, I'm so glad that you were right in a way, and they found it and operated, and you're still here now. And obviously, I know with cancer, they'll still be monitoring you. Yeah, we'll do all the touching wood that all the actors should do if you're listening.
Yeah, spit and turn.
Yeah, and I think that's incredible. And like, you know, what else can you? I don't feel guilty. Just good. If somebody should survive these things.
Yeah. Like, well, and you know, the way going back to my dad, you know, the way he approached his illness was completely inspirational, and he kept on going back in, and the fight was worth it, you know, and that's what I.
Yeah.
What I took away from him. There were many great years after diagnosis, and if we're talking about legacy, I don't know about heaven or hell or spirits being retained in robin redbreasts bouncing on your garden. But I think the sort of strength of character that he gave me is his legacy. And that's another thing I wanted to bring here.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for bringing that spirit and talking about Mr. Graham Williams.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. As I said at the beginning, if you head to www.demandsurvivalnow.org.uk, you can sign a petition to help the government recognise the emergency that currently is pancreatic cancer. And if you want more information, please do head to the PC UK website or PCRF as well. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. The show was edited by Kate Holland with thanks to Whistledown Studios, and the music was provided by the Glue Ensemble. And remember, you're not alone.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.